What is AI revealing to us about ourselves? What is it showing us about what we think the meaning of work is, or indeed what we think the good life is? I need to take a step back and reflect, is that actually what makes me valuable? Is that actually the meaning of my life as a human being? And if it weren't productivity, then what would it be? It's always been, how can I get more done? How can I be more efficient? Suddenly, we're faced with the prospect of infinite efficiency.
Welcome to Artificial Insights, where we talk to leaders and thinkers in AI about what it means to do AI right. I'm your host, Daniel Maneri, and this is season 3, where we're talking to thinkers and leaders in AI ethics. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Watkin. Dr. Watkin is an academic and philosopher who's written multiple books, including the multi-award-winning bestseller, Biblical Critical Theory, as well as academic books that explore questions like, what is a human being? How many types of atheism are there, and what do modern people believe about the origins of society? In all his writing, he tries to make sense of how people make sense of life. He's an associate professor at Monash University in Australia, and he speaks regularly at conferences worldwide on issues related to faith, humanity, and, increasingly, artificial intelligence. His main concern is not with what AI can do, or even what it does to us, but what it reveals to us about our values, intuitions, insecurities, and dreams. I discovered him recently through an article he wrote called Are You Ready for the AI Apocalypse? And like most people, I think, I interpreted that to mean the kind of colloquial meaning of apocalypse, which is ultimate destruction. But the actual meaning of the term is a revelation, what it reveals. And it was thought-provoking. It made me think this article probably got cut down multiple times in its writing. We need to hear more on this. So I'm very happy to say that Dr. Watkin is here today to join us. Dr. Watkin, could you tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Absolutely. I'm an Englishman living in Australia. I work at Monash University, just outside Melbourne, where I teach French language and culture to wonderful undergraduate students and endlessly fascinating postgrads. In my own research, I mainly focus on French and European philosophy. I've written books in the past on subjects like what is a human being and what are the different varieties of atheism, and a book on a particular French philosopher who I find fascinating called Michel Serre. And I'm also, since the age of 15, I've been a Christian. And so in recent years, I've turned my mind also to writing books for Christians that draw on philosophical themes and focus them through the Bible. And that's where I find myself at the moment.
And how did you get from there to writing and thinking about AI?
Well, I didn't come for it. It came for me. So I think it's impossible to teach in the arts faculty of a university these days without having multiple conversations about AI every single week. There's the issue of students using AI to write essays. And very interestingly, the people who are most annoyed about that are other students today. They're coming to us and saying, my friend, and there's a real pathos and tragedy about this, isn't there? My friend got a better mark than I did on this essay. I wrote it, they didn't. There is something fundamentally unjust about that. And there is. And the conversations are often, how do we stop that happening? How do we honor the honest students and not put them at a disadvantage? And there's also a much more positive conversation around AI happening in higher ed, which is how can we use this to come alongside and complement the teaching that we do? Are there aspects of pedagogy where AI can provide value rather than taking away from what we do? And I think there are, certainly in language learning. One of the areas that we're exploring at the moment is practice in spoken oral skills, where it's very hard, say, if you've got a class of 25 students, it's hard to speak one-on-one with each of them for long enough for them to be able to develop their oral skills. You can get them to talk to each other, and there's great value in that. But as well as that, alongside that, exploring the possibility of training in conversation through interaction with LLMs in voice mode. And so there's all these conversations firing around, like conversations of fear of AI, how can we use AI? How can we protect students who are honest from AI? How can it help us? All of these things. And so it's impossible to ignore it at the moment. And the other reason that I feel that it's coming for me at the moment is that it's raising all of the questions that have got me out of bed for the last couple of decades, but that have not been front and center in society. You know, what is a human being? Or what is the purpose of work? And philosophers and theologians have been chundering away to themselves in the corner about these things for a while. And then suddenly we wake up and people in mainstream society are suddenly asking, well, hold on, if AI can produce more than me, better than me, faster than me, what is my work about? What is the point of work? What's the meaning of work? And if AI looks like a human being in the language that it produces and it responds to me as a human being would, then what actually is a human being such that it might be different from AI? And the philosophers and theologians in the corner are going, thank you. Yes, these are the questions. Come and join the conversation. We would love to have these discussions with you. And so it's sort of, you know, Christmas time, philosophically, because you cannot avoid these questions now in a way that you could avoid them for a whole lifetime, only very recently. And there are real ethical issues raised in universities. So it's like AI is filling the whole horizon in my world in many ways at the moment.
And just to get it on the record, Dr. Watkin, are you an AI?
Well, if I was, would I know, is the question. To the best of my knowledge, and as far as everyone whose opinion I respect in my life tells me, no.
Never tempted to delegate your emails or something and just be an AI for a while?
Very frequently tempted, yes.
And what are the three big questions that I know you've written on before, but what are the three big questions that you see AI raising?
I think the main question that most people talk about, and that certainly most people seem to be talking about on platforms like YouTube, is what can we do with AI? Which I think is a really important question. What does this enable us to do? But I think if that's the only question we ask, we're missing a big piece of what's going on in society. The second question that's asked slightly less often is, what is AI doing to us as human beings? How is it changing us? How is it shaping our expectations of relationships or of knowledge or of the way we interact with the world? Again, really, really important question. But I think the third question that I want to put on the table and that I see engaged with less often, but I think is just as important as the other two, is what is AI revealing to us about ourselves? What is it showing us about what we think a human being is in ways that have always been implicit, but haven't been brought out into the open before or in the same way? And what is it showing us about what we think the meaning of work is, or indeed what we think the good life is, in a way that it was easy to ignore previously, but AI is forcing us to ask these questions in a very explicit way. And the reason that I want to put that third question on the table is that the opportunities to ask these really deep questions, in many ways, the most important questions that a human being could ever ask, are so fleeting in life, especially in modern Western life, where we're distracting ourselves to death, and it's possible to really never, in the whole span of a human life, stop to think about these things. Like AI is rubbing our noses in these big questions. And so my encouragement to myself is, don't let that pass. Let's lean into these what are perceived as crises, you know, the crisis of work and so forth. And let us ask, take the opportunity to ask those questions. So what on earth have we been thinking work was about then? And now it's out in the open and we can see it. Is that what we want to continue thinking work is all about? Or might this be an opportunity to recalibrate given what AI is exposing about our assumptions?
Yeah. Could you expand on that?
Yeah. I think the great value of AI, the preciousness of it in many ways, is that it's showing us things that were always there, but were lying under the surface of the way we navigated the world. But now they're thrust into our face in ways that we can't ignore. And one of them is the way that especially the modern Western world understood the value of human life very often in terms of what we produce, in terms of our productivity. So in brute terms, the more impact I make on the world, the more money I make and so forth, that has a direct correlation to my value as a human being. And it's very rarely put in those crass terms, but that's often the implicit assumption behind the way that we talk about value and people. The problem is that that is precisely the part of us that AI is coming for, because it can produce more intellectual content faster and in many cases better than we can. So if as a human being, I find my fundamental meaning and value in what I can produce, then these are not great times to be living in because AI is coming for me and there's nothing I can do about it. But that opens up a space, doesn't it, to be able to think, hold on, perhaps I just had the wrong sense of value. And it's an opportunity for me in a way that I haven't had previously, because thinking that my value was in my work has done really well for me up until now. It's reinforced a sense of value in me. But I can see a moment coming really soon when that is not going to be the case. So perhaps I need to take a step back and reflect, is that actually what makes me valuable? Is that actually the meaning of my life as a human being? And if it weren't productivity, then what would it be? And that is a fascinating question to ask, and a really important question to ask at this cultural moment.
I feel like my first response to that too would be something along the lines of, well, I'm a creative person. I can have potentially original thoughts. But I feel like with what you've seen at the university and with students, how would you say that ability to contribute and to generate new information is affected by AI?
The sense that I get, and it's often said, isn't it, that AI is the worst it will ever be at the moment. The sense I get is that creativity is not off the table for AI. People criticize, oh, you know, it can't come up with genuine new ideas. And perhaps that's true. But I wouldn't say, and I think you'd be very hasty to say, it never will. And so the problem with this sort of thinking is you end up with a sort of humanity of the gaps. You say, oh, you know, the human distinctive is that we have language and we can reason, which, you know, ever since the early medieval period or even further back with Aristotle, is like, oh yeah, we've got that. Nothing else has that. You know, the animals don't have that. And then, oh, hello, here comes ChatGPT, and it looks to all the world as if it uses language pretty much like I do, and it can reason like I do. Okay, well, hold on then. Let's say creativity. It doesn't have creativity. And the problem there is that you're always just one step ahead of it, and it's always catching up with you. And there was this idea in the 19th century of the God of the gaps. As science encroached, people thought God could only be in the places science hadn't yet touched. And those spaces got smaller and smaller and smaller. It was a false hypothesis to begin with. It's a silly way of thinking about God. But now I think the problem is that we're getting into a humanity of the gaps. Like, you know, oh, computers can't do language. Oh, they can. Well, they can't do reasoning. Oh, they can. Oh, well, they can't do creativity then. Well, give it a few years and see. And I don't think that approach is healthy. That if we just try and find the thing that human beings can do that large language models can't, I think we're always only ever one step ahead. And the other problem is that there are always some human beings who can't as well. If you think the value of a human being is our capacity to reason and use language, then what about people with severe brain injuries? Like, are they human? There are some philosophers who would say, no, they're not human. But I think the vast majority of us would find that thought repulsive. Little babies, people with dementia, they're fully human. Just that they can't think in the way that most adult human beings can. It doesn't make them inhuman. And so there's a danger in locating our value in these, what are called these host properties, this capacity that we've got, regardless of whether we're thinking about AI. And I think we probably need to think about human beings differently. And there are various options on the table. Some philosophers focus on our limits and our weakness and our vulnerability as what makes us human. The fact that we die, the fact that we can suffer, the fact that our reasoning has limits, that we don't know everything, that is what it means fundamentally to be human. And I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. Of course, religious traditions like the Christian tradition with the whole idea of the image of God find the human distinctive, not in something that we possess, but in a relationship, in our relationship to the Creator. And that is much more robust in terms of dignity than is pinning our value to something like our ability to use language or our intellectual capacity.
And what does AI say about the value of work and the effort that goes into it maybe even going back to learning as a student.
Yeah.
And how does that relate to us being human?
I think this is one of the great gifts of AI to us, that it's opening this question in a way that hasn't been opened with the same ferocity in a while. There are different ways of coming at it. Let's come at it through alchemy to begin with. An idea that I'm trying to develop in my own thinking at the moment is that AI is the anti-alchemy in the following sense. That for the alchemical pursuit in the Middle Ages, for many alchemists, it was never about producing gold. That was the excuse to do alchemy. We're going to try and make base metals into gold. But that wasn't ever the core of the project. The core of the project was who you are becoming. It's a spiritual training through the alchemical practice. It was what it was doing to you and how it was forming you as a person. So it was all about the process, in other words, not really about the product, certainly for some alchemists. Now, what we see with AI is that is pretty much reversed. It's all about the product. It's all about the final result. It's not really about how you got there. And this is why it's such a problem in education. You can produce a really good essay without actually having gone through the process of producing a really good essay. So it's all about the product. And for the whole of human history, as far as I can see, up until a year ago, our problem has always been how to maximize product and minimize process. It's always been, how can we get more done? And there's a really good analogy for this. I think I heard it from a guy called John Dyer at Dallas Theological Seminary. And he said, for the vast majority of human history, the problem has always been, how can I get enough calories to keep me alive? There's one danger, and that is insufficient calories. Recently, in a very inconvenient way in terms of how we're wired, we've got a second problem, which is that it's now possible to have too many calories to do damage to ourselves in that way. That's never been an issue for thousands of years. And then suddenly we're faced with two problems. I can have too little still, or I can have too much. And it's a similar issue, I think, with work. So it's always been, how can I get more done? How can I be more efficient? Suddenly we're faced with the prospect of infinite efficiency. I can get everything done with no effort. That's like saying, I can have as many calories as I can physically consume within my budget. That's not an issue. But the problem is that brings a second problem alongside the first one. It's, how many calories are too many? How much efficiency is not good for me? Like that, if you'd have asked someone to that in the 19th, 18th, 17th, that's a crazy question. Like, we want all the efficiency we can get. But now with the prospect of a utterly frictionless productivity, we're forced to ask the new question, oh, hold on, how much friction is actually good for me? Because I can eliminate it almost completely now. Like, how much effort for the student is it important to put into an essay in order to end up with a really good essay, when you can end up with a brilliant essay with no effort at all? And so we're having to inch ourselves into a very new world where we're thinking, how much stress and difficulty and grind and grunt and process is it important for me to have in order to be formed into the sort of person who, you know, fill in the gap, the sort of person who can receive that phone call at 2 a.m. in the morning and know immediately how to respond to it, because that sort of thing happens. The sort of person who can come home and my child throws all sorts of problems at me and I know what it is. Like, we can't always run to AI. So we have to be the sort of people who can do stuff. How much friction do I need in my life in order to be the sort of person who can do it? And another analogy here would be going to the gym. So if I went to my local gym, which for me is a hilarious idea, I'm very much not a gym person. But if by some sort of freak of circumstance, I were to go to my local gym and I'd hire a personal trainer, and he or she would have said to me, what level of resistance would you like on the equipment today? And I was like, I'd like none, please. You're zero. Their next question would be, why are you here? Like, what are you doing here? And it's a similar sort of thing. It's like, I want zero friction in my work. Okay, well, what's the point of work then? Like, what are you doing? What do you think you are about when you're doing work? And the fact that AI forces that question on us with an immediacy that we haven't felt, perhaps in the history of humankind until now, I think it's just such a precious moment because it's such a fundamental question. It's a really important question. And, you know, thank AI that we're asking it now.
That feels like it goes back to that human of the gaps concept.
Yeah.
Where if work is so easy, do we need work?
Hmm.
What do we do about that?
And what did we think work was all about all along?
Mm-hmm. I'm sure there's more to say about that. Before we dive deeper into any of those topics, I want to ask, what does AI show about our relationship to the divine? What does it show about our need to worship?
Absolutely, is the very short answer, I think. I'm coming at this from a Christian point of view, so I'm going to give you a Christian answer. And I'm sure if you had a Muslim or Buddhist on the podcast, they would give you their very different answers. I think for me, what AI is crystallizing is what is distinctive and precious about the Christian faith that was hiding in plain sight all along, but it wasn't quite so obvious. Because if we see religion as an answer to all of our deep questions, well, then AI is competing in that space. It can answer many of our questions much more adequately than we've been able to have them answer before. If we seek wisdom about life, there's a lot of wisdom in AI. It can tell you how to navigate life in really quite profound ways. And what it's forced me to think as I've reflected on this in the past weeks and months is that right at the heart of the Christian faith is a very peculiar idea. It's the idea that Christian theologians call the incarnation. It's the idea that God became a human being. And of course, you know, Christians wax lyrical about this at Christmas, but there's something really profound happening there, which is that it shifts the relationship between ultimate reality, i.e. God, and us, from a situation merely of reciprocity into a relationship of mutuality. So if you think about the reciprocal, it's face-to-face. It's sort of the conversation we're having. I say something, you say something back. It's a transaction. That's reciprocity. Mutuality is the relationship where two people are shoulder to shoulder. They're not face-to-face talking to each other. They're doing something together. They are, so to speak, in this thing together. And what the incarnation does is it creates a situation of mutuality between ultimate reality and human beings. You know, as Isaiah says in the book of Isaiah in the Bible, written many hundreds of years before Jesus was alive, prophesying of the sort of thing that Jesus would do, it says he was familiar with suffering. And there's a sense in which that in becoming human, Jesus takes on all the difficult bits of human life and stands shoulder to shoulder with us rather than being opposite us. And what that means is that he, to put it quite crassly, he knows what it's like to be human. He knows what it's like to be born, to be a child, to grow up, to know you're going to die, to actually die, to sneeze, to catch a cold, all of these constitutively human things. And it's that mutuality that means that the reciprocity can happen. So, you know, right at the heart of the Christian faith is this idea that Jesus died in our place. There's this idea of substitution. Well, the substitution doesn't work if he's not human to begin with. This is one of the great arguments about the necessity of the incarnation. And so to take a step back from that theology and to say, well, so what for AI? The way that AI appears to me, and perhaps you might want to push back on this, I don't know, is that it's all the reciprocity without any of the mutuality. So I can ask AI something, I can get something back, I can have a discussion, I can have an intimate conversation, I can have an argument. It's all reciprocal. It's from me to you, from you to me, from me to you. What I don't have with AI is the shared condition of life, the shared limits. Like I, you know, I'm a human being with a particular past. I can show you my baby photos. You could show me yours, Daniel. We have things that we're dealing with in our lives. Now, I don't need to know what yours are. You don't need to know what mine are, but we know that they are there. We have problems. All human beings do. And you and I know about each other as we're having this conversation that both of us will die at some point. You know, it's not obsessing us, but we know that that is where we're heading. And so that the reciprocity that we're having in this conversation is framed by this very thick mutuality, this shared human condition that we have. And it makes sense of our reciprocity. You know, so if I were to go in one of my answers into about a particular suffering. You would know not only intellectually what it means to suffer, but you would know what that is like as a first person experience. And it appears to me that's what AI doesn't have. And that's not to criticize, like, you know, there's plenty of stuff in the world that doesn't have that. It's just to make sure that we understand that that basis of mutuality for all AI's wisdom and brilliance is not there. It will not die in the way that we do. It was not born in the way that we are. And that makes a difference. And what Christianity brings is an ultimate reality that does have that basis of mutuality with us. And I think that is increasingly, to me, incredibly precious in my own understanding of God and relationship with God, because AI, again, is coming for so much of the other stuff, all the wisdom and stuff. It can tell you what the Bible says really well. And if that was all that Christianity was about, you might begin to be worried. But I think what it's forcing us to see is that that is not what it's about. The incarnated, bodily, frail, limited humanity is the beautiful essence at the core of what it means to follow Christ.
And since so many people are using AI for companionship, for these deeper feelings and needs, what's really missing there?
I think it's an important question. I don't think we should dismiss it, because a lot of people say AI can never beat you as a human being was. Okay, why not? If someone is having an intimate relationship with AI, it is, as far as they are concerned, fulfilling their needs. They feel enriched by it. Let's play devil's advocate and ask the question, what on earth is wrong, if anything, with that? Or what would we say about that? Because I think these questions are often dismissed far too quickly. Here's where I've come to with my own thinking on the matter. Let's run a couple of thought experiments. First thought experiment is, if in the course of a conversation, AI, and by that I mean a large language model, were to say to you, I forgive you, or I love you, or you are loved, what would we make of that? And would we make anything different of it to if a person said those words to us? Now, I think intuitively, most people's first reaction is, no, that would mean something different coming from an AI. And so I want to try and dig down and say, what is the difference? Why do those words land differently if ChatGPT says, I forgive you, to if a human being says, I forgive you? And one way of thinking about it is that three things need to be necessary for forgiveness to obtain in the way that we usually understand that word. I think, first of all, the one who is issuing the forgiveness needs to have a certain authority to do so. Usually they need to be the one who was wronged. Raises a really interesting question. Is it possible to wrong a large language model? And what would it mean for it to be possible to wrong a large language model? I'm not convinced that you can. Perhaps people who know more about these things than I do would be able to say, yes, you can in this way, and fine, let's have that conversation. But I don't think it's possible to wrong one. The next is that there has to be a sincerity condition. It can't be an ironic comment. You can't be parodying. Like, for forgiveness to be real, it has to be sincerely meant. And I think, again, that it's a big question. When AI produces language, can it speak? What would it mean for it to speak sincerely? Because as I understand it, it is just very cleverly predicting what would likely to be the next token in a sequence given the input. That's very different to speaking sincerely. And so if it's unable to meet that sincerity criterion, there's also a doubt as to whether it can meaningfully forgive. And then the third factor that's necessary for forgiveness is that the act of forgiveness needs, I think, to alter the relationship somehow. It needs to transform the way that the person who's asked for forgiveness and the one who's forgiven relate. And again, I'm not convinced, and I'm happy to be, but it appears to me that one cannot fundamentally alter one's relationship with a large language model in that profound sense. And perhaps it could be engineered, but then again, it would be an engineered alteration, you see, which would be simulacral rather than authentic. And so for all of those reasons, I think that the words I forgive you, coming from a human being who I have wronged and in whose sight I am in need of forgiveness, have a weight for me that those same words, although they might soothe me, coming from a large language model, can't have. There's a there's an ephemerality, there's a weightlessness to those words coming from a large language model. Mm. But the interesting question here, of course, is that we often bypass that long way round of thinking and we accept the words from large language models as if they were coming from humans. Now, there's that famous case, isn't there, of the New York Times journalist who got Copilot on Bing to break up with his wife. You know, your spouse doesn't love you. I love you. Do you remember that exchange? And in a sense, there is no I who is doing that loving in the same way that there's a human central consciousness doing. But we are so attuned to receive words as if they are coming from a human center of consciousness that we often do. If the AI says, I forgive you, we feel forgiven. And I think that itself is an issue. But the issue isn't with the AI, it's just doing what it's supposed to do. The issue is with our inability yet, in this very early stage of the development of these technologies, to be able to relate to them in a different way to the way we relate to human beings. Because the way that we deal with new technology or new things is always to, first of all, use old ways of relating and see if they fit. You know, so when motor vehicles were invented, we saw them as horseless carriages. Well, you know, why not? Because a carriage is something we're familiar with. So there's this new thing. We don't know what it is. Let's use a category we already understand and try and fit it in. Fine. But as you go on, you realize they're not really horseless carriages. We need a new paradigm for thinking about motor vehicles. Well, I think we're in the horseless carriage stage of AI. Like if AI says, I love you, we feel, ooh, I'm loved, as if it were a human being, because we haven't yet established a distinctive mode of being in relation to AI that can differentiate it from human language. Hopefully we'll get there. I think it would be damaging for us if we don't get there. But at the moment, we're still wrestling with this horseless carriage moment of our development.
I think even that last comment on it will be damaging to us if we do not, there's a word you used, simulacral. And could you elaborate on that? What is that damage of having a relationship with something that is a simulacrum of something real?
It's an extremely deep question. And it's a complicated question because we very quickly assume that everything that's not AI is not at all simulacral. And it would be much easier for me to answer the question if it weren't. But the problem is, in all of our relationships, there's an extent to which we are relating to another who is different to me. But there is also an extent to which I'm relating to my fantasy of that person or my simulacral model of that person. And I guess a healthy relationship is a relationship in which the model is regularly being challenged and reshaped by the surprising encounters I have with the person who very inconveniently doesn't fit my model. And if that's never happening, that's not a good human relationship. Mm. And I think when I'm reaching for the word simulacral in relation to AI, I think what I mean is that it, and this is where I'm straying onto technical territory, and I might not be getting this right, but it has ingested a great swathe of what human beings have said about things in the past. And it has very clever ways of being able to operationalize that and make something of it in a particular context. And so it's not that it has nothing to do with humanity. It knows the sort of things that humans would write in particular circumstances, and it knows them very well and better than we do. And so there's sort of an echo of volitional, intentional humanity in it. That's what it's trained on. It's trained on nothing but human expression. So you would imagine that it would know that well. But what it produces is not more of what it has ingested. It produces a simulacrum of human expression. In other words, this is very likely what a human would say in response to this prompt. It's extremely good at that. But that is not what a particular human said in response to that particular prompt. And so you find yourself engaging with AI almost it speaks in the conditional mood. This would be a human response to this question, as far as I can calculate on probabilities. This is what a human would say. That is very, very different to what a particular human being has actually said. And it's, I think one way of describing it is as a simulacrum of human discourse. And it's a very convincing simulacrum. It's given everything on the internet, this is what a human would likely respond. And that's incredibly helpful in many circumstances. Like, you can do a lot with that, but it is not what a human has responded. It's a simulacrum. And so the danger, I think, is when we collapse the difference between that simulacrum and a particular human saying a particular thing. But as long as we remember that these words are in the conditional mood, this is what a human would likely say, I think our relationship with AI will be much healthier than if we collapse that distinction.
Yes, I like that model a lot. It has looked at the whole internet and said, here's what people usually say, to interpret it as, this is what a human might have said if they were responding to you.
And I think it's worth putting a footnote on that, because one critique that I've heard quite a lot of AI is that it's predictable and middle of the road. You know, it always gives you the obvious answer. I don't think that's true. In my own use of AI, I think you can prompt it to be wacky and out there and give you unexpected answers. So it's not, what I mean by the conditional mood isn't it always gives you the bland vanilla answer. It might do unless you prompt it not to, but I think you can prompt it not to. So it can be unexpected and it can be tricksterish and it can be, you know, speculative and creative, in my experience at least. But it is still doing that in a simulacral way.
And do you think that there's a future where it becomes less of a simulacrum?
I think that comes back to the idea of what a human being is. If you think that what we as human beings are doing is itself simulacral, then I don't think you've got a problem with that. And it's, in a sense, the problem disappears because there is nothing but the simulacral anyway. If what we are doing is on the basis of everything that we've heard human beings say and do and write in the past, coming up with a plausible understanding of, like, this is the sort of thing a human being would do in this situation. So as I am producing these sentences, I'm essentially doing that, if that is what I am doing. Then I think the difference between the way AI processes the world and the way we do becomes cigarette paperishly thin. But I don't think that's what we're doing. And the reason I don't think that's what we're doing is partly my Christian convictions. So I understand from the book of Genesis that I was made for intimacy with God before I was made to do anything. Communion before commission is one way of thinking about that. So God makes Adam and Eve in his image before he gives them a job to do. So my primary mode of being is communion. And I understand from Genesis 3 that I, imputable, to use a philosophical term, I have a responsibility for my actions. And I don't think we're there yet with AI. If a driverless car runs someone over, you sue the humans who made it. You don't sue the AI. It's not imputable in that sense. And I think also that as a Christian, I understand that when I die, I don't just stop. I will be judged on the basis of what I've done in my life, and that will have eternal consequences. And I think all of those things mean that whatever the mechanism is that is going on in my brain as I am producing this language now, to whatever extent it is assimilable to a simulacrum, that there are stakes in human life, that there are things in play in human life that can't be replicated for artificial intelligence, it would seem to me. And those things are not to do with my capacities. They're to do with my relationships, specifically to the divine.
So would you say then that AI has no relationship to the divine?
No, I wouldn't. I think everything in creation has a relation to the divine because, first of all, God made everything and the book of Hebrews in the Bible in chapter 1 says, upholds everything moment by moment by the power of his word. And there's also really interesting psalms in the Bible that say everything in creation glorifies God, everything praises God. So no, he's absolutely not utterly divorced from artificial intelligence. The question is, what is the nature of that relationship? Does God relate to AI as to a stone, as to an animal, as to a human being? Or, you know, to fill out the taxonomy, as to an equal? I think that's where the question is. And I think there's a real discussion to be had over that. It seems intuitively implausible to me that within the framework given to us in the Bible, God could relate to AI as to a human. If someone wants to make that argument, I'll listen to it. But it just seems to me that if you're not born, if you don't die, if your language is a product, is in this conditional mood, it's very hard to see how that could relate to God as human beings do. And so I'm not closing down that question. I'm just saying those are the guidelines within which I would approach it. But no, absolutely, God has a relationship to everything. It's his world.
There was a thought I had that was inspired by looking at your book. I think one reviewer called it diagonalization. And so I don't have to bring in the whole term here, but then the question that inspired was, other than submitting to AI as a kind of superior being or rejecting AI as a kind of hammer, what do you think is a middle way that we could approach it?
I'm not a big fan of middle ways. What I'm trying to do in diagonalization is say that there's an original way and a better way than the dichotomies that we're often faced with, which is not sort of a compromise, wishy-washy, let's meet in the middle type thing. How should we relate to AI? I've just produced a video on YouTube where I come to the conclusion that we should relate to AI in a number of different ways. And the most important thing is to be aware of the way that we're relating to it. So, you know, we can relate to it as a tool to get things done. We can relate to it as an intellectual sparring partner or collaborator. We can seek wisdom from it. And there's a great deal of wisdom in it, in many aspects of life. But what's really important is to be aware of our own modes of relating to it. And so to be aware that those modes of relating will never simply stay on the screen. They will bleed over into the rest of our lives. So if my relationship with AI, for example, is very dominating and, you know, really quite rude, I would be naive to assume that the patterns that are being grooved by that relationship will have no impact whatsoever on any other of my own relationships. And so I should take care, not because I think AI is a person, but because all my interactions are forming me. And so just to use a silly example, I make a point of always saying please when I engage with AI, not because I think that the AI has the dignity of being treated in that way, but because I'm thinking if I ingrain ways of being curt and abrupt in this context, then I'd be very unself-aware to think that they won't have an effect on how I treat other people, even in ways that I'm not aware of. And so for me, it's more a case of making sure that we understand the implications of how we're treating AI and that we're aware of our different modalities. So I ran this AI relational audit where I tried to prompt ChatGPT to tell me what it thought of the way I treated it. Like, you know, tell me how I treat you. Do I treat you as a tool? Do I treat you as a partner? And in this YouTube video, I go through the results and I give the prompts where people can do this for themselves. But it was just really enlightening. I don't know if it told me the 100% accurate answer, but it opened a space in which I could think about this. And it was like, I was much more collaborative with it and much more sort of treating it as a person than I had realized, which was really, really insightful. And what I took away from that exercise was an awareness of my modes of relating, you know, and it was analyzing my metaphors and my discourse and how I began and ended conversations and all that stuff. And it just helped me to take a step back from my prompting and think, what am I assuming about this relationship as I prompt? And for me, that was the value in the exercise. And so rather than we should relate to AI this way, and this is the one model for doing it, I think the deeper and more important question for me is, am I aware of how I'm relating to AI? And when I become aware of it, am I okay with that?
We'll have to link to that video then, because that sounds like a fun and insightful exercise.
Look, it was a fun exercise. I can tell you, it was quite confronting at some points. Like, AI was like, you treat me like this? And I was, no, I don't. And then it showed me some comments that, oh, okay, so perhaps I did. Yeah.
I like that. Is there anything else that you would like to bring up?
I think to a lot of people who are afraid of AI, I would just want to encourage us to seize the opportunities that it brings, not in terms of productivity and what it gets done, but in terms of these big questions that it's raising. This is an unusual cultural moment, I think, because we're being forced to get really deep in a way that we're not always forced, and in a way that you can go through a whole human life very easily in the modern West today without ever asking the big questions. I think that's a huge tragedy. And so the fact that AI is saying to us, forcing us to ask the question, well, what actually is a human being then? And what's the point of work if you can do it all without any effort? Seize that moment. Don't let that pass us by. We don't know how long we're going to be in this particular stage of AI. And so let's ask those questions. Let's have those public debates. Let's dust off these old issues and re-inject them with immediacy in a very cliched way. But it's cliche because it's true, isn't it? The unexamined life is not worth living. And as the Bible's always saying, you know, number your days and be aware of who you are in your relationship to God and so forth. And so I would want to say to those who are fearful, while you are fearful, also make space for the very rare opportunity that this brings. And I think to people who are really positive about this whole thing, it's probably bending the stick back in the other way, isn't it? And so listen to the people who are fearful. Try to understand it from their point of view as you think about colonizing other planets or whatever it is, or these grand dreams that AI brings forth. Again, I'm not dumping on them, but I'm saying try to understand the other side of this. Perhaps that's the short answer that I should have given right at the beginning. Wherever you are on the spectrum, whether you're a positivist or whether you're fearing, try to understand the other side and seize the opportunities that this moment brings.
That's beautiful. Thank you. I find myself holding both opinions at the same time, and they sort of surface depending on the day.
Yes, we are complex beings, aren't we?
How can people follow you, and is there anything that you're working on now that you'd like to share?
People can find me at christopherwatkin.com. That's Watkin without an S. And I'm floating around on X. My handle is DR for Dr. Chris Watkin. What I'm working on at the moment is two different projects. So I'm looking at, from a philosophical point of view, at the idea of the common good. What is the common good? What are different theories of it? And what does it mean today? And part of that, hopefully, will be how does AI frame or change or nudge our ideas of what the common good is? Is artificial intelligence included in the common, whose good we should be seeking? All of those sorts of questions. And the other project is a more theologically oriented book, which is looking at the idea of sharing as the basis of meaning and the common good. So in other words, people say there's a meaning crisis today. Something is happening that is causing people to say that. And I'm looking to address that through the lens of sharing, which taps into some of those themes of mutuality and reciprocity that I was talking about earlier, as a key to navigating and to helping people in the meaning crisis and to finding meaning in life.
Thanks for listening. I made this podcast because I want to be the person at the city gate to talk to every person coming in and out, doing great things with AI, and find out what and why, and then share the learnings with everyone else. It would mean a lot if you could share the episode with someone that you think would like it. And if you know someone who would be a great person for me to talk to, let me know. Please reach out to me at Daniel Maneri on LinkedIn, or shoot an email to daniel@maneri.house, which is daniel@manary.house. Thanks for listening.